Otherwise, I'll read it the whole time I'm up here. My name is Beth Hartley. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Beth.
And because of the grace of God and the fellowship and steps of AA and sponsorship, I've been sober since June 26, 1988. Yeah. And that always amazes me when I say that. I got sober, actually, in Cincinnati, Ohio. We moved to North Carolina about 7 years ago, and when I got there, they told me that CARE actually stands for Containment Area for Relocated Yankees. So that's why we live there and not Raleigh or Durham or somewhere. So I want to thank the committee. We've had just a fabulous time this weekend. Although, I being the southerner that I am, I came up here with linen clothes and sandals. And because it's May, I mean, you know, it's 90 at home. My husband played golf today. And so we've been keeping warm. But we've just had a really good time. Everybody is so nice up here, and thank you so much. Everybody's done a great job. Oh, it always takes a minute to get going. You all mostly look like you've been coming to AA for a while. Not that you look old, but just, newcomers, they kind of get that look in their eye like a dog lost on the freeway, and I don't see anybody looking too panicked in here, but if there's anybody new here, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous and let you know that if you're not thrilled to be here, it's okay. We don't care. I didn't want to be here when I got here. I was not one of those people who walked through the doors of AA and said, oh, thank God I'm home and I want what you have. And that just wasn't my experience. I started going to AA meetings in the 60s. I'm holding up pretty well, don't you think? My dad got sober in 1966 when I was 7 years old, and so I knew there was Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that if you were alcoholic, you didn't have to drink, that there was a solution. I used to be the kid in the corner at the Friday night speaker meetings in Hamilton, Ohio. With the coloring book, I knew that AA was all old guys who drank coffee and ate donuts and smoked. They used to smoke indoors back then. And so if you got up to like table height, everybody disappeared. It was really anonymous in those days. You couldn't see across a table. And I knew it was there, and I didn't have craziness in my home. I didn't have drunken fighting parents. My mom is an alcoholic. My dad told me the drama and the tragic losses and the crushed hopes and dreams of his drinking. And I didn't drink till I was 15, but when I did drink, I felt so bad for him that he had such a hard time. I just thought if he drank more like me, he could have hung in there longer. But I was an only child, and the longer I'm here, the more aware I am that alcoholism was my problem, not alcohol. That alcohol was never my problem. Alcohol was my solution. And we were talking today that, you know, if I went 10 days without a drink, it was a long 10 days. And if you were my friend, it was longer for you than it was for me. People were usually offering me a beer by the end of the 10 days. But I had all this thinking long, and I wouldn't have told you I was a thinker. I was an avid reader as a child. I read a lot. That was my first escape. I could dive into a book and the house could have collapsed around me and I wouldn't have heard it. And I think because of all the reading, that's why school came easily to me when I got there. It certainly wasn't any work ethic. If it looked hard, I just didn't do it. And because, there's always that possibility of failing in public if it's hard. And so I got good marks in school. I know I'm a test taker. I'm one of those people, the test taker. A comment from the peanut gallery over here, who must not be a test taker. So I could study it, spit it out, not know what I read 3 days later. And if you're a test taker, you can ace treatment. You can be. I was always voted most likely to stay sober forever in all the treatment centers, because I can say all the right things and do all the right stuff. But on the inside, I just never was enough. I never felt good enough. There was always a committee in my head from the very beginning. They were all up there. None of them liked me. They all told me things like, they don't really like you. They just play with you because their mother makes them. They're all talking about you now. And I just never could, I didn't want to try anything new, like I said, because if you fail, then you look bad. And I can't ask a question. I live by this rule that it wasn't all right not to know. It just wasn't all right not to know anything. Pick a topic, I don't care. It's not okay not to know. I wouldn't even ask a question in school, because if you ask a question, everybody knows that you don't know. And if you asked a question, I would be embarrassed for you, because now everybody knows that you don't know. And I just, you know, and I never could, like, I just felt like if I said my name's Beth, that you were waiting for the rest, that just being Beth was never enough, that if I said, hi, my name's Beth, you would just think, and? So I always had to be super busy. I was, you know, Beth the cheerleader, Beth the night auditor, Beth Jim and Sally's daughter. Always had to have Beth the something, because if I wasn't doing a bunch of stuff, I couldn't justify my space. You know, I had to do big things just to feel like I deserved the space I was taking up. And I couldn't, you know, I would have one good friend at a time, and don't talk to my friend because she'll like you better. And then I'll have to find another friend because, you know, I can only have one at a time. And it just on and on and on like that. And when I got here and they said we suffered from self-centeredness, I didn't get that. I thought self-centered meant selfish and vain. And I'm just, ask me, I'm neither of those. And, you know, I didn't know that self-centered meant I thought everybody was watching every move I made. You know, I was a spectator in my own life. It's like I had this little camera in my brain that watched all of you watch me. And if I was talking to somebody over here, I was acutely aware of how it might be looking to you over there. And I just couldn't make a move without calculating all that. And I remember I was telling Gary, my sponsor says that alcoholics don't really have conversations. It's just two people talking most of the time, you know, and because we don't listen well, we're just talking. And I remember the first time I was about 6 months sober having a conversation with somebody and actually realized that I would talk and then they would talk and I was listening, you know, that I wasn't figuring out what they were going to say and choosing from my next six answers, you know, that we were just like, they would talk and I would talk and they would talk and I would talk. It was so amazing. I had never done it before because it was just busy up here. And one of the stories that really made it evident to me, when I got sober, my kids were 4 and 6. My daughter was 4 and my son was 6, and they weren't in my custody. But as they got older, my daughter wanted to swim. And, you know, she's the one that when she was younger, we thought she'd be here by now. She was something else. And, you know, Chuck and I used to tell people that most people save for college, we're saving for treatment. And because we just knew she was going to be here. And when she was 11, she wanted to be on a swim team. A lot of her friends swam. So we thought, okay, fine. We took her to try out. And the coach told her, well, you could be on the team, but you need to swim down an age group. You need to practice down an age group because you can't keep up with your age group yet. Now, this meant that at 11 years old, he wanted her to practice with the 9-year-olds. And it was okay with her. I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have gotten in the water. And she was fine with that. Now, I was 7 years sober. I'm always so embarrassed to tell you this. I was 7 years sober when this happened, and I was having a hard time being the mother of the 11-year-old that had to swim with the 9-year-olds, you know, because how am I going to look? And so she practiced with the 9-year-olds, and she went to her first swim meet, and these were USS big meets where they run all the heats and just post the results. And her very first race ever, she was 70th out of 72, and she went back the next day. I would have been trying to get my parents to relocate. And we said, well, Sarah, you didn't win, but you have this baseline time now. And next time you race, even if you don't win that race, if you beat your time, it's a successful race. Now, the whole time I was telling her this, I was thinking, oh, yeah, right. You know, I mean, it's about the medal. It's about winning. She beat her time, and she was happy. Now, the rest of that story is, 2 years later, she was a state AA swimmer. And at 11 years old, she had never had a drink and neither had I. But I would have walked away the day they said practice down an age group. I could not have done it because of how it would look. And she just somehow internalized that lesson that they try to teach all of us about set the goal, work for the goal, achieve the goal. I mean, that just went by me. My outlook on life has always been, just give me the goal, you know? I used to say I was kind of a 50-yard dash girl in a five-mile world, you know, great starter, terrible finisher. But really, I don't even want to start. I would so much rather just set up a lawn chair at the start line and let you bring me the trophy. I just... My husband told me I'm a type AL, and there may be some others of you out there. I said, what is that? He said, well, you're definitely a type A personality, but you're lazy enough that you're not annoying. So, and it's true. It really is. So anyway, you know, we start watching her with interest because we had been so convinced she'd be here. And then she's, you know, doing this stuff at the swimming, and she got a summer job and saved money. And in 9th and 10th grade, she still had the same friends that she'd had, you know, in kindergarten. And so we're watching her with interest, kind of going, is this normal? And like we would recognize normal, you know. And she just went on like that. She, by her junior year in high school, they'd opened up a Starbucks in our town, and she came home the first day of school and said, you know, we went to the new Starbucks. And we said, oh good, who'd you go with? Oh, Lindsay, Katie, and Jennifer. And I said, Jennifer, you went with her? And she looked at me and said, for God's sakes, Mom, that was 6th grade. Could you let it go? I can't tell you this day what that girl did, but I don't like her. You know? She just, so we're looking at this child who sets goals, works for the goals, achieves the goals, you know, keeps the same friends, doesn't carry resentment. And we just said, you know, there's supposed to be one mature person in the house. Congratulations, we're pretty sure it's you. And she's 26 years old now and married, and has a beautiful daughter who's going to be 3 on the 4th of July, and still, you know, doesn't appear to be alcoholic. We don't know how that happened, but she had such a bright future in AA, and then she just took a weird turn on us. What are you gonna do? You know, all parents have dreams for their kids. Anyway, I mean, if that gives you an idea of what my thinking was like, and that was long before I drank, and so I was busy, busy, busy in junior high. I was, you know, pep club, honor society, band, student council, yearbook staff, you name it, I did it all. Because if I sat still, it was too noisy. If I was alone, it was too unfriendly. I always had this chorus in my head of people who didn't like me. And one of my favorite promises in the Big Book says that we can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Because I just couldn't. I just couldn't. I never could. And in high school, when I took a drink, all of that stuff, I wouldn't have told you that I relaxed. I wouldn't have told you anything. You know, a lot of my friends were experimenting. They were falling down, throwing up, looking bad. So I just put a glow on the first time, and it was enough. It was enough that I took my best friend out the next night to get her drunk so I'd have somebody to drink with. And that friendship didn't make up for another year because we drank different from the beginning. You know, from the beginning. If I could have gotten it every day in high school, I would have been a daily drinker. I have no doubt. I never had issues with morning drinking. I think it only makes sense to drink in the morning when you're in high school. You know, you have to sober up before your parents get home from work. It was very practical. And on the topic of practicality, I was telling Jay, she was talking about that bottle rolling around under her car seat last night. I said, you know, that's why I drank Wild Irish Rose. The bottle was square and it doesn't roll out from under the car seat. So you have to be, you know, have to think these things through. But I started drinking in high school, and immediately I was off and running. And I could drink with the big boys, so I did. You know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and they said hang out with the women, I was horrified. I just horrified. I thought, I don't even drink with girls. Why would I want to hang out with them now? You know, I mean, in high school, they're girls and they fall down, they throw up, they wear pink in public, you know, they just, and later it would get complicated because it was, you know, I mean, like, oh, that was your husband. I'm so sorry. And just never thought to ask that stuff at last call, you know, which is where I did my dating mostly. So, I mean, you know, it's like, if they're still there on Sunday, it's a relationship. I had a one-night stand drag into a 5-year marriage based on that never admit when you're wrong rule. And But, you know, I didn't hang out with women. I didn't want anything to do with women. I didn't, because, you know, women to me, they were competition, or they were of no consequence, or every now and then there was one who could look me in the eye and I knew she could see right through me. Because underneath it all, I never had a clue what was going on, but you can't tell anybody because it's not all right not to know. And every now and then somebody looked me in the eye and I knew she knew, so they had to be avoided too. And I could drink a lot, so like I said, I drank with the big boys because I could. I had a huge capacity for alcohol. I loved to drink. Sometimes I forget to mention that. Loved to drink. My day went better with a drink. I could drink a lot. I wasn't a falling down drunk. I wasn't a crying drunk. I wasn't a fighting drunk. Mostly out of sheer cowardice. I was afraid if I hit you, you would hit me back. But, you know, I look like I would hit you, so most people left me alone. And really, I mean, you know, I mean, when fights break out, drinks get spilled. It's just a waste. But I just, you know, I was just a happy drunk, or I would have told you I was a social drinker, you know, and the more I drank, the more social I got, and hence the last call, dating a lot. I was very, very social by 2 a.m, friendly even, and, you know, I just loved it, and I grew up in Ohio. That was my first resentment. I didn't want to be from Ohio. I don't know if any of you have been to Ohio. I'm not hearing big bursts of applause, so that tells me a lot. I was born in California, but I guess because of my dad's drinking, they moved to Ohio when I was like 2. And I can remember being 6 years old. As soon as I found out it was warm other places year-round, I was on a campaign to get my parents to move, and they never would. I can remember being in first grade, looking at a map of the United States and seeing California and Florida and Texas and Ohio. And just think, you can look at a map and tell that nothing is happening in Ohio, you know? And where does that come from at 6 years old, you know? I mean, I know now, I was already at 6 years old, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. Already at 6 years old, if I lived somewhere else, I would be happy. If we had a different house, if my mom acted different, if she didn't smoke, you know, the other moms don't smoke, if we had this, if we didn't have that, I would be better. And that just carried on and on and on. If I, you know, later in life, if I'd come with them, if I'd left with them, if we'd gone to this party, if I hadn't gone to that party, I just never, ever was comfortable where I was. Every now and then, all the planets would align, you know. But most of the time, I was wishing I was somewhere else, with somebody else, doing something else, because where I was just never quite fit. And one of the big gifts I've gotten here is wanting to be where I am most of the time. You know, that my sponsor says, be where your hands are. And most of the time, I am comfortable where I am, wanting what I have. And that is such a huge gift, because I just chased that and chased that and chased it. So I'm in Ohio, I get out of high school somehow, mostly because I didn't drink my freshman year, so I had a lot of credits stacked up. And I go off to college because I grew up in a college town. That's just what you did. And I went to college, and I was a 17-year-old freshman in the middle of a 21 state, and I didn't have a lot of access to alcohol, and I was just miserable because I don't know what to say after my name's Beth. I don't know what to say after my name's Beth. Like I said, I feel like you're waiting for the rest. So if I meet you and I say, hi, my name's Beth, and she says, hi, my name's Joanne, and I know it's my turn to talk, you know? Everybody in my head launches, telling me it's my turn to talk. She's staring at you. You should say something. Well, you'll look dumb now if you talk. You'll look dumber if you don't. But yeah, what are you going to say? You know? So it's like they're all up there arguing. I'm paralyzed. We have to go. And, you know, I just couldn't do it. I just didn't know. And the same thing happened when I got to AA, because when I walk into a room full of people, it splits into 2 groups, you know, all of you and me. And you all know each other, and you're all talking big book stuff, and I don't know anything, and I have to go. And it just was like that. I ended up, I flunked out of school. I hear it's helpful if you go to class. I might, you know, tried that later in life. But I just couldn't do it. And I go back to Ohio, and I get a job, you know, in a bank, because that was, I knew everybody was watching, right? So I get a, you know, banking's respectable, and you can do that without a degree. And they worked on Monday mornings. That was not working out for me at all. And I had a friend who had a friend in Florida, and he said, we should go. And I said, we should. I had always wanted to run away from home. I was ready. I made a run for the border with him. And 2 weeks later, when I called my mom to tell her where I was, she asked me why I didn't just tell her I was moving, and I thought, well, that's kind of stupid when you're running away from home. And she said, you know, Beth, you're of age. You could have just left. And I thought, oh, you know, I mean, it never once occurred to me that I was of legal age and I could just say I'm moving and go. I mean, I was on the run. And, you know, I got a job down there at a convenience store, and it was so transient down there that if you went to work 3 days in a row, you were management material. So I was assistant manager by the time I called her. And, you know, and she said something to me that she said a lot. She said, how could you do something this stupid and land on your feet? It just made her crazy. She had this crazy idea there should be consequences for your actions. I never really liked that rule. And so I'm in Florida. Well, now there's no checks on my drinking down there. And, you know, it's one of my rules in Ohio was don't drink before noon, you know, unless it's 80 degrees out. You know, as soon as it's 80, crack that beer. Well, I'm in Florida. Now it's 80 at 7 o'clock in the morning. Yes! You know, and I lived in this little tiny town. It was 3 miles from one end to the other. And these people bought beer on this end of town to drink on the way to the bar on this end of town. Those are my people. And by the end of 8 months, I was looking like I was going to maybe have to move to Ohio back home because I couldn't support myself. I was out of places to work. I was out of guys to date. There was only 3 bars in that town, and I just was running out of options quickly. And I had so known that Florida would be my answer. You know, we have a friend in Cincinnati, and he said, really, they should have just put a sign at the state line of Florida, Arizona, and California that said, this state doesn't work either. And we could have all just, you know, you'd say, if you see a car pull up, read it, and then just turn around and leave. You know, it's an alcoholic, you know. But they didn't have a sign, so, you know, I'm down there, and I'm thinking I'm going to have to move back. And then this guy, you know, miracle of miracles, this guy moves to town from California, and he didn't read the sign either. And that was, you know, he had everything I was looking for in a guy. He had a house, a car, and a job. And, of course, the joke was on me. He got tonsillitis 2 months later and didn't go back to work for about 3 years. But, you know, I never, what I've realized in sobriety was I never really, like, dated who I was dating. I was always dating potential. Do you ever do that? Just date potential, you know? Oh, this is who he's going to be when I'm done with him. And, so anyway, we hooked up, and that was just, you know, kind of 5-year slow, torturous dance that we did together. And you know, it just was, is he alcoholic? I have my ideas. You know, you can't declare anyone else alcoholic. But, and it was pretty easy to look good next to me back then, but I don't know how he would stack up next to, you know, somebody who wasn't one of us. And we moved to the Keys. You know, we had our son, and then we moved down to the Keys. We went down on 4th of July weekend. We liked it. We came home on Tuesday, moved on Friday with a baby and $400. Hey, let's move to the Keys. Hey, Mom, move to the Keys, but don't worry, I'm assistant manager at this restaurant, you know. You can just hear her kind of pounding her head on the phone saying, how can you do that and land on your feet? Because I was like that guy in the cartoons that walks down the sidewalks and the safes and the pianos just kind of crash behind him, you know. I mean, I would get clipped every now and then, but I just never got what I should have gotten. The first car I wrecked, I drove because I couldn't walk. And, you know, and I smashed into a bridge, and there was no DUI. There was no license suspension. I got a bill from Butler County for the bridge. And the only time I was ever suspended from school, it snowed, so there was no school. You know, I mean, that's the kind of goofy stuff. They're so happy for me when I tell that one in the jails. You know, they're just so thrilled that I never got caught. But that's the kind of stuff that happened to me. I just would skate out of it over and over, and I just kind of counted on that. I just kind of always knew I would skate somehow. And we moved down to the Keys, and we're at this oceanfront resort in the Upper Keys, and it's, you know, there was another resort down the road where the old, like, quiet money went, but we had all the Miami drug money where we were, and it was fast boats and outside issues and $100 bills and Tiki John's rum runners, and it was just, all the security guards were bikers, you know, it just was a fabulous place to work, and I went from the restaurant to being their night auditor. And now they've doubled my pay, and there's 7 bars on the property, and I have a key to all 7 bars, you know, and they pay me. It's still, I think that might be the best job I ever had. And you know, my job at night, I would go around and ring out the register at the one bar, and we'd have a drink, and I'd ring out the tiki bar, and we'd have a drink, and then we'd go lock the elevator upstairs at the restaurant bar and have a drink and do some outside issues so we could stay up the rest of the night. And, you know, because I was a child of the 70s, and there was stuff, you know, floating around everywhere, and if you had it, I would do it. You know, you always hear this, my drug of choice, and I mean, my drug of choice was yours, you know. If you had it, I would do it. And you know, there was a lot floating around, and I did most of it. You know, an acute fear of needles probably kept me from killing myself. I can't even look when they give me a flu shot. It's really embarrassing. But, you know, it was there. I did it. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't struggle with, am I an addict or am I an alcoholic? Because I realized that, you know, eventually everything that interfered with my drinking had to go. Everything. My kids, my integrity, my employability. And the drugs had to go too, because the drugs began to interfere with my drinking. I reached a point where if I did these, I was blacking out at 6 o'clock instead of midnight, and that's just not good on an extended period, you know. And if I did this, this over here was my kind of I'm not drinking drug, because nothing tastes good anyway, and there was a lot of that in the Keys. And, you know, the only one I miss sometimes is the diet pills, because it's the only time in my life where I was thin, I could drink for days, and my house was clean, you know? I have never been able to accomplish all that together since. But we, you know, it was expensive in the Keys, so we started a little kind of home-based business, a little part-time job, and in addition to our regular jobs, because there was a lot of importing and exporting down there, as you can imagine, and so we opened up a little just local distributorship, and got arrested, as you could imagine. So I remember do you ever tell a normal person what you really think and then just look at the look on their face, you know? I told the probation officer that I really just thought of it as a part-time job, and she just gave me one of those looks that they give us, and she said, well, Beth, you know, you may think of it as a part-time job, but down here we call it sale of a controlled substance. And I was like, oh, well, you know. But even that, you know, we kind of skated out of that too. And by now I want out of my marriage, because a lot of this is he is my problem, but I can't say that I want out, because then it will be my fault if the marriage fails, you know. So I just drank until he couldn't stand it, and he said get out, which is what I was working for. And when he said get out, he only had to say it once, because now it's his fault. That's all I was looking for, was it would be his fault, because I can't say I made a mistake. And I called my mom, and she wouldn't relocate me in Florida, but she would send me a plane ticket back to Ohio. And, you know, what was I going to do? I had a two-year-old and a baby. So in 1984, I moved back to Cincinnati, Ohio. And I thought, okay, maybe I should go to AA. Maybe. I really thought if I just quit drinking with bikers that my life would calm down. But, you know, so I tried, like, my mom's neighborhood. The whole neighborhood just kind of stepped out of an L.L. Bean catalog, you know. It just very suburban. And I was not very suburban, but I went to a bar in her neighborhood, and the only guy in the whole place in a Harley shirt bought me a drink. So I was like, well, there you go. You know, what's a girl to do? But I tried AA, and in Cincinnati in 1984, I mean, I was only 25, and Young People's was on fire down there. IKIPA had just been in Cincinnati in 1983. They had a Monday night meeting that was 200 people. They had a Friday night meeting that was 150 people. It was enthusiastic, active, sponsored, structured Alcoholics Anonymous. But like I said, when I walk into any room, it splits into two groups, all of you and me. And I walked in and looked around, and, you know, and I don't want to be new, right? Who wants to be new? Because we know you don't know if you're new. So I might have given them my name once, but people weren't really remembering my name enough. And not that I ever volunteered anything past that. And you all knew each other, and I had to go, you know, because I can go to a bar by myself. If I got $5, I'm good. You know, I know who can drink as much as me. I know who shoots pool as well as me. I know who knows where the party is when the bar closes. That's all I need to know. And it's really easier to go to the bar by yourself, because you never know when true love is going to strike, and you got to be free to go, you know what I mean? And can't have to take your friend home. And so I just, you know, I tried, And then by 1985, my kids were removed from my custody because I was home and there was nothing to drink. And they were in bed, and I walked down the street to the bar. There was a bar about four doors down. And my son woke up, and he couldn't find me, and he came out on the front porch and cried, and the neighbors called the police. And when the police came, it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out where I was because my car was parked right out front. So they just called down to the bar to see if I was there and did I want to come home. And my mom got that call that no mom wants to get at 2 in the morning, you know. Come get your grandchildren because your daughter's under arrest. And she had to get out of bed and come pack up those kids and take them to her house. My daughter was 15 months old, and my son was 3. She was totally unprepared for children. But I'm not hurting anybody. Leave me alone, butt out. Mind your own business, you know. That's what I'm telling her. That's what we all tell our family. We're not hurting anybody but ourselves. Butt out. And so she gets these kids, like, bam. She was my age now when she got the kids. And I went down to jail overnight, and then they told me that if I went through treatment, I maybe wouldn't stay in jail, so that seemed like a good plan. And I found a treatment center. It ended up being all women and 6 weeks long. That was just God's cruel joke on me. But I was, you know, and I was going to get out and go be sober with my dad. And my dad died the 10th day I was in there. And I was devastated because I was going to go be Jim's daughter. I don't know how to be Beth. And now that's shot to hell. And it turned out I'm the only child of divorced parents, so I got all the insurance money. And I got to drink like I wanted to drink for the next 2.5 years. But I didn't know that right away. And while I was in treatment, something interesting was happening. Because like I said, I'm a test taker. And I already had my own big book when I got there. Because when I lived in the Keys, I had been fired from that perfect job because I went to happy hour one day at 5, and I was still there at 11 when I had to clock in, and they weren't very happy with me. And so I went to an AA meeting because I kind of knew, you know. So in 1983, I go to the Tuesday night Key Largo group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a small discussion meeting. Now, I've been to some meetings with my dad, but when they went around and introduced themselves, I would just say, my name's Beth, I'm with him. Because I don't know about you, but when you have a sober parent in AA, you can't wonder if you're alcoholic. You can't say out loud, you can't put out into the universe your name and the A word in the same sentence. You know, I've heard people say they just sat in the bar and said, oh, I'm alcoholic, who cares? But if you have a sober parent and you know there's AA and you say, oh, I'm alcoholic, who cares? A big book drops out of the sky. The bartender will hand you a meeting schedule and the AA police will come get you and take you to a meeting. So I never wondered. But I went to this AA meeting in the Keys in 1983, and it was a discussion meeting, and there was maybe 15, 20 people there, so everybody's looking at you, you know, and they were very nice, and they were very... The meeting's over at 9, 9:30. It's a Tuesday night. They invite me to Perkins. Do they have Perkins here? Tim Hortons, same kind of thing, right? So... And I'm just looking at these people. They're all old. I mean, they're 40, 50, you know, old, old, old. And it's 9:30 at night, and they've invited me to Perkins. You know, I've got a Harley parked down the street, and I'm just thinking, okay, it's Tuesday night at 9:30. I've just been invited to Perkins. My life is over. I was a bar drinker, and... you know, but I went to my boss and told him I knew I had a problem. I was going to AA. One AA meeting, I get my job back. AA works, it really does. And I went to the Friday night Key Largo meeting and told him I got my job back, and that was pretty much the end of my AA career in the Keys. And then, so I gave it a shot in 1984, you know, and I know I gave it a good 2 weeks. I mean, I know I did, but it just wasn't happening. And then in 1985, I end up in treatment, but I'm a rock star there because I have my own big book already. Because, oh, that's what I was going to tell you. When I went to this meeting in the Keys, I called my dad and told him I'd been to a meeting and that I said I was an alcoholic. That's the first time I ever said that I was an alcoholic. And within a week, I got a box from him, and it had a big book. And at 12 and 12, each day a new beginning, 24 hours a day, one day at a time, a tape of his talk, a few bookmarks. I don't know how long he'd been gathering it all up, boy, but one meeting, it's in the mail. The box is in the mail. So when I get to treatment, I have a tape of my dad's talk. I have my own big book already. I've highlighted in case you want to see what I think is important. You know, I've highlighted a few things in case you're flipping through. And I'm a test taker, so I can ace treatment. And I was the one that got to talk to women who didn't want to leave their children for 6 weeks. And I could tell them all the right stuff, better 6 weeks now than forever later, because if we're not sober, we can't be parents. But the problem was developing quickly, and that's what the book talks about, a double life that we lead, the one we want the world to see and the one that we know is true. And what was happening was I was realizing pretty quickly that I did not want my children back, that I was glad they were at my mother's house, that it was too hard to be a single parent. And at my mom's house, they were getting read to every night before they went to bed. And they were getting a bath every night. And they were sleeping on clean sheets. And they were going to daycare on time in clean clothes. And they were getting dinner at dinner time. And I couldn't do any of that. And I hated her for doing it. I would set her up. This is the kind of daughter I am with untreated alcoholism. When my kids would come visit me on a weekend periodically, on Sunday I would start to talk to them about getting an apartment soon so we could live together again, knowing it was crap, knowing it wouldn't happen, but knowing that they would go home excited and tell grandma about it, and she would have to be the bad guy and talk them down. That's the kind of daughter I am with untreated alcoholism, but leave me alone, I'm not hurting you. You know, I can't believe what I put my family through. And so the kids stayed at mom's, and now I've got the insurance money, so I kept drinking, and for the next 2.5 years, I got to drink like I wanted to drink, and the kids stayed at my mom's. I went through treatment a couple more times to stay out of jail, and by the end of 1987, I'm living in a friend's attic. I lived in an attic, too. I used to say I moved into an attic apartment, and when I was about 17 years sober, I realized it was not an attic apartment. It was an attic. It was not an apartment until I got there, you know, and it's just gray in the Midwest in November, and I would wake up, and it would be 5:30, and I didn't know if it was day or night, you know. And I think, well, I'll go back to sleep, and when I wake up, it'll be dark or it'll be light, because I didn't have enough money to drink all day. So I couldn't bear the thought of getting up at 5:30 and heading to the bar and find out it was 6 a.m. instead of 6 p.m. So I'd think, oh, I'll just go back to sleep, and when I wake up, you know, then I'll know. And I would toss and turn and sleep forever, and wake up and it would be 5:45 and it would be gray. And I just, when I look back, it's just like there was just no color in my life. Everything was just gray. And after I got sober, I remember thinking, why didn't I just get sober? You know, did you ever think that? I mean, those of you who knew AA was there and kept drinking, why didn't I just get sober? You know, I knew what to do. We're all good at talking about knowing what we need to do while we sit in the bar. And, you know, what I realized, and I didn't realize it till somebody else said it. I was listening to a guy speak in Cincinnati, and he said what it came down to was he knew if he drank, he would probably be miserable, but he knew if he didn't drink, he would definitely be miserable. And as long as he took a drink, there was always a chance that this would be the night that it worked again. You know, that there was at least a shot at having a good time in that bottle. And I thought that was it. You know, that was it. And I just kind of hit an emotional bottom and the end of 87 and just prayed one night, God, I cannot live like this anymore. You've got to do something. And I remembered the big book that my dad had sent me, and I pulled it out and I read Bill's story, because that's where I always start when I read the big book. It's page one, right? I mean, if they wanted you to read the Roman numerals, they would have made them page one. And I just, you know, you get to treatment. If you've been through treatment, you get to treatment and they tell you, this is the design for living. The instructions are in the big book. And I would open to page one, Bill's story, and it would say, war fever ran high in a New England town. And I would just think, oh yeah, this is helpful, you know? I mean, what do you do with that? He's old, he's dead, who cares? But that night, you know, what I didn't know was that Bill's story was just a speaker meeting in print, that when they put that book together, there were not meetings on every corner. And they put one man's story of what he was like, what happened, and what he was like now in the front so that somebody like me could read it, maybe identify, and maybe keep reading. And that night I read Bill's story and I identified for the first time. I felt how he felt. I knew how he thought. And I slept with my big book. And the next morning I woke up and I felt pretty good. And I didn't really want to drink. But that was the end of that effort at sobriety. You know, because I did then what I did a lot. Nothing. You know, I didn't pray again. I didn't read another chapter. I didn't go to a meeting. I didn't call anybody. And by the end of the day or the next day, the voices in my head were saying, oh, you may as well drink. You know you're going to drink. Just get it over with. And, you know, there are several times in my life where I can look back, and I'm convinced, you know, if you've got a period in your life where you know God removed the obsession to drink, but then later you drank anyway, you know, I can see 3 or 4 times in my life when God took away the obsession to drink. But it doesn't stay gone forever without my cooperation. You know, there's a guy in California that says, if you think God will do it all for you, lock yourself in a closet, and when you get hungry, pray for a hot dog. You know, there are things that we have to do. And I was great at surrendering, you know, because I said, I'm a coward, really, and I'll surrender if the heat's on. But staying surrendered is kind of tricky, you know, because I don't know about you, but when I've surrendered and, you know, crawled back to AA, about 2 weeks later, I'm feeling better. And the first thing I get back is my opinion. And, you know, once I got my opinion back, I can start evaluating how well you are doing and what you're doing here and how well you're doing it and where I stack up against you. And I don't really need to do everything you do. And, you know, lame, lame, lame. You know, I mean, who wants to go to AA, really? Is it that there's just kind of like this trend down in the States now where almost every weekly drama, one of the characters is going to AA? Has that happened up here? Or do you watch the same? I mean, it's like, and I always think, no, don't do that, because don't they look lame on television? You know, when they're in that, like, thanks, Buffy. It's like, oh, you know. And I was thinking, oh, my God, they're just doing damage here because it looks so lame. Who would ever want to go? Right? And then I realized that's how it looked to me when I went and didn't want to be there. You know what I mean? That AA looked lame to me right up until it didn't. But that you catch that spirit in the room, and that really you can't catch that spirit on TV. And that was, you know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? That it's like when I walked in the room the first time, I could have been watching it on TV. It looked just that lame to me. But all of a sudden, it just shifted, you know, and that spirit is catching. And so anyway, I did end up drinking again then at the end of 87, but weird things started happening. I mean, I was drinking in the Dewdrop Inn in Norwood, Ohio. Great place. I think every town has a Dewdrop Inn. And, you know, the bartender starts talking about getting sober, and some guy I'm shooting pool with used to go to this AA clubhouse in Cincinnati, and I'm surrounded by people talking about AA, the books, Big Book, and 405 Oak Street in the Dewdrop Inn. And I mostly didn't drink in early 88, on and off a couple times, but, you know, by June of 88, I just had this brilliant thought that I'd been gone from Florida 4 years, and I bet everybody down there was going, God, I wish Beth would come back. And so I ran away from home for a second time at 29 years old. I had an emergency credit card of my mother's. You know, I was allowed to carry it for emergencies. And I'll tell you, getting to Florida was an emergency that day. And I took off to Florida. And thank God, back then, $3,000 was a big limit on a credit card, or else I'd be in prison now. I mean, I would have done damage you couldn't undo. But I got down to Florida, and of course, there was no homecoming parade, and nobody was really excited to see me. And on June 26, 1988, I was in the airport in Fort Myers, Florida. And the credit card wouldn't take a plane to get home, and I didn't even have a dollar for a beer. You know, I didn't have enough money for one drink. And if I had enough for one, I could have gotten two. But I didn't have enough to go get the first one, and I didn't want to be asked to leave the airport bar because we don't want your kind here. You know, I just couldn't bear the thought of that. And I'm looking around, there's a lot of retired people in Florida, and I thought, well, I could just snatch a purse of a little old lady, you know, and maybe I get lucky and there'd be some cash in there. But I was so hungover. And I knew I would pick on the little old lady that still did aerobics twice a week. She would run me down and take her purse back, and I would look oh so bad. And so I called my mom and told her where I was and what I had done, and she said, call me later, and hung up. That wasn't looking real good. And I called her later, and she said, I've booked you a plane ticket, but I want you to understand that I'm really not flying you home. I'm flying the children's mother home. And it's only because we're afraid we'll never see you again if we don't. And I got on a plane June 26, 1988. I hadn't had a drink all day. I didn't get a drink on the plane. I had no idea it was going to be my sobriety date, or I'm sure I would have tried. And when she picked me up at midnight at the airport, she drove me straight to the county detox. And I was not amused. I just wanted to go home and go to sleep. And she said what I know now is one of the hardest things she's ever said, because I'm her only child. This county detox is in a particularly violent part of Cincinnati. It's on the national news periodically for violence. And she took me there and she said, go in or don't, but you can't come home with me. I'm done. I've done everything for you that I can do. You have to do it yourself. And when she left that night, she didn't know really if she would ever see me again. You know, her only child. Because if I had turned around and walked away off the steps of that place, I could have just wandered off into the night and been gone. And, that, you know, I mean, they don't even find bodies down there most of the time. But I'm not hurting anybody. Leave me alone. So I went in, and the next morning I wake up, and I'm 29 and a half years old. And, you know, I really never had planned to be 30. I just figured I'd be dead. I just never, you know, I mean, why make plans if you're not going to be there? And I, you know, because I mixed drugs and alcohol, and I drove drunk, and I rode motorcycles drunk, and I ran around with very large men in black leather that had weapons, and, you know, I bartended in places where people shot at each other, and I just should have been dead over and over and over and over. And now I'm in this detox bed, and I'm 29 and a half years old, and I realize that I am distressingly healthy. You know, I just clearly am not going to drop dead of natural causes anytime soon. And if I was going to be dead from some other cause, it would have happened. And I mean, the only reason I never tried to kill myself is I knew I would live. You know, I knew I'd be one of those people that lived, and I'd just be maimed and look bad. And I just, it was like this voice came down and just said, people like you don't die, Beth. And I just was like, oh, God, you know. And I realized that I was going to live another 40 or 50 years whether I drank or not. That there, you know, I mean, I was a wino at 29, you know. And there was a lot of, and I had done a lot of stuff women have to do to drink, but there was a lot of it I hadn't had to do yet, and I knew it was out there. And I was still, you know, I mean, I had all my limbs and both eyes and all my own teeth, and I knew all of that could go, plus a lot worse. And I knew that day with clarity that no matter how bad it was, it could get worse, and then it would get worse, and then it would get worse, that there were levels of worse out there I hadn't even thought of. And one of the things I've learned living in the South is somebody was talking one day about how to boil a frog. Now, you may not think you need to know this, but bear with me. If you throw a frog into boiling water, it will jump out. If you put a frog in a pan of cold water and turn up the heat a little bit, he'll adjust. And then you turn up the heat a little more, and he'll adjust. And you turn up the heat a little more, and he adjusts. And next thing you know, he's in a pot of boiling water dead. Now, isn't that alcoholism? Isn't that alcoholism? It gets worse, and we adjust. And it gets worse, and we adjust. And every now and then we rally, but we never, you know, we started up here, and then we adjust down, and we adjust down, and we rally, but we only rally to here, you know, but we rally just enough that the next day we're like, man, I almost overcorrected and went to AA, you know? Thank God I didn't do that. It's better now. And then down we go again. And I knew that's what was in store for me, whether I drank, you know, if I kept drinking. And I just had this passing thought that whatever those people in AA are doing seems to be working for them. And what I was doing clearly was not working for me. So I kind of turned myself into AA. And when I got out of detox, I got out of detox on Friday of 4th of July weekend, which I guess you guys probably don't celebrate a lot up here, but it's a big, big holiday down there. And everything was closed until Tuesday. My car was impounded. I wasn't sure why yet, but I knew there were some pending charges that had to do with it. And I couldn't get my car till Tuesday. I'd made arrangements to go into this hotel for women. That should have been a sign of surrender. I couldn't get in there until Tuesday. I couldn't do anything until Tuesday, and I'm getting out of detox on Friday. And I just scraped up enough money to get in a cheap hotel that was on the bus line, because I knew if I went to the town where I lived, I would drink. I knew that. My experience said that. And so I just stayed in this Drake Motel on Reading Road. They had a pool and no bar. And I went to a meeting the first night out of detox, and this woman talking, she was given a lead, and she told the whole room full of people that alcoholism had taken her to the place where she didn't want to work, and she didn't want to take care of her daughter. She just wanted to drink. And I had never heard anybody say they didn't want to care for their child before. That was my biggest secret. That was the one I couldn't tell anybody. And she was telling a whole room full of people So I got her number after the meeting, and I called her the next day, and it took forever because, you know, it'd be like, oh, she doesn't really want you to call. Everybody's in committee now, you know. And she'll say, Beth who? You know, she doesn't want to talk to you. On and on. And finally, after half an hour, I called her and just said, I got your number last night. I have no idea what to say to you. I'm practicing using the phone. And she just laughed and said, that's what I had to do too. And that's what I tell new people. Just call me and tell me, you know, practice dialing the phone. We don't have to, or do, I guess you don't even have to dial anymore. But by the way, as Allison was, do y'all know your sponsor's phone number in this age of cell phones? Because I'll tell you what, when you forget your cell phone, it's good if you know your sponsor's number. That was something I learned. They told us, because when I was sober, we didn't all have cell phones yet, but speed dial was coming into vogue. And somebody said at the meeting, oh, and I have my sponsor on speed dial, ha, 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 you know. And somebody said, don't do that. Because if you're out somewhere and your butt's falling off, memory 5 is not going to help you in a payphone. And I just took that to heart. And even still, I call my sponsor every week, and I dial her number every week. Every week, you know, 402-291-5283. That is my sponsor's phone number. And if you don't know yours, you should learn it. Cell phones break, cell phones get lost. And anyway, so I was gone, but now I'm back. Oh, God, my son and I, you can't set us loose in a hardware store together. There's so many shiny things. We just get lost. So I started going to AA, and I started going to this big book meeting because I knew from all my trips through treatment, you should read your book every day, right? And I thought this would count if I went to a big book meeting every day. Because when I read at home, I couldn't read anyway. My brain was sawdust. If I tried to read at home, I would open the book, and 20 minutes later, I'd still be on the same page. Or else I'd be 20 pages in and have no idea what I read. And even in a meeting where they were reading it out loud, it would still kind of go like, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed, or I wonder what it will cost to get my car out of impound today. I better call that guy after the meeting, you know? And it'd be like, somebody turn the page, and I'd be back, and... But, you know, and they would go around the room. They read a whole chapter at every meeting, so then maybe I wouldn't get called on because that chewed up half of the hour. And I had my day free at 1 o'clock. It was just a win-win all the way around. But God's got a great sense of humor. And what happened was I had my day free at 1 o'clock every day, and at about 4:30, I'd remember that I had no life. So I go back to the clubhouse at 6 for the 8:30 meeting because I just had nothing to do. And you know, when they were reading it, I started to hear it. And I know I started to hear it because I'd started answering phones at my mom's office because I was pretty much unemployable, but I could go answer phones for her. And I would leave at 11, go to the noon meeting, and go back after. And I went to the noon meeting around 3 weeks sober. And I'm on my way back to her office, and I stopped in a Walgreens or somewhere to run an errand. And I decided to check in and see what everybody's talking about, right? Because, I mean, they're all still up there now. I just don't check in with them much. So I pop up into my head to see what everybody's talking about, and somebody in my head is going, that was so cool what Guy said at the meeting today. And somebody else is going, I didn't know that was in the book, did you? And somebody else is going, I didn't know that was in the book. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, the voices in my head are getting sober, you know? They're up there discussing the meeting without me. And okay. I'm out of here. And I just left them alone. And God's biggest joke on me was that people who go to big book meetings on purpose tend to read the book and do what it says. And what I had done by going to that noon big book every day was plop myself into the middle of the most active people in Cincinnati AA. And they just dragged me into it. They had me answering phones at intergroup by the time I was 9 days sober. They had me in there on Tuesday and Friday, so I couldn't drink in between. And they, you know, and I was going to 2 meetings a day, and about somewhere between 3 and 4 weeks sober, somebody said, Beth, you've been around before. Why don't you write an inventory? And I thought, okay, why don't I? Never occurred to me I could be not ready. So I got the big book, and I followed the directions, and I wrote the inventory, and that woman who didn't want to take care of her daughter became my sponsor, and she heard my fifth step, and this was all before I was 4 weeks sober, and I have never looked back, never, because you know what? I could not have gone 3 months or 6 months or a year or, God forbid, 3 or 4 years without writing that inventory. I could not have done it. There was too much noise in my head. And that was, it quieted the voices, and it allowed me to go on. And you know, the big book says, there's nothing in there about a step a month or a step a year. It says if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you are ready to take certain steps, period. Period. And I'm so glad nobody made me wait, because my life took off and I have never looked back. And I got in the middle and I stayed in the middle, and my kids started spending weekends with me, and they would just come to meetings. My kids did 4 meetings a week from Friday to Sunday because I didn't know what to do with them. You know, my biggest fear was that I would be unable to love my children. I was afraid that alcoholism had just stripped me of the ability to even love. But I brought them to meetings because I didn't know what else to do with them. And you guys taught me how to talk to my kids and get to know my kids. Because when I brought them to meetings, you would sit down in a chair and look them in the eye to talk to them. And you called them by name. And you knew they played soccer. And you knew who played what position. And that they had a big game last week and who won. And you colored with Sarah. And you asked them to help you go get coffee cups. And my children, who had become invisible around me, because what they heard from me over and over was, "I love you, go away." You know, because I had nothing to give them. "I love you, go away." And now people were talking to him and calling him by name and asking him to help. And their gaze came up off the floor and they became less invisible and they began to look the world in the eye. And I learned how to watch my kids watching you guys talk to my kids. And what a gift that was, you know. And we started doing stuff and we do all the eating meetings. I got sober in June. And so by the next year, there's picnics, and we, you know, we know a ton of people because we go to all these meetings, and we went to an eating meeting in June, and now my kids are like 5 and 7, and I'm a year sober, and we get to this picnic, and I said, "If you guys want to go play, go ahead." And I always said that to them, and they never went and played. They always just stuck by me, which is fine. I only saw them on weekends. And this day, about half an hour after we got there, I felt a tug on my leg. And my son Robbie said, "Mom, I just wanted to let you know, if you need us, we're over here playing." And what I realized was that was the first day they knew they could let me out of their sight and that I would be there when they got back. And it took a year, you know, it took a year. And my mom and I talked when I was a year sober, and we decided it really didn't benefit anybody for me to get the kids back all in the name of family unity, because by now they had been with her they were with her 3 years before I got sober. So when I was a year sober, they'd been at her house 4 years. They were in one of the best school districts in the state. They were in a clean, safe neighborhood. They'd had the same friends into the school system for 4 years. And I lived in a 10th floor efficiency in a crappy part of town in the Cincinnati Public School District. It just didn't make sense to drag them down to where I was in the name of, you know, reuniting the family. And so Mom and I talked, and we decided that I would catch up to them. Because they were doing what they were supposed to do. I was a disruption in their life. And I started going back to school and, you know, eventually moved out closer to them. In the meantime, when I was, I don't know, I guess about a year and a half sober, they had this thing called Monday Night All Group Gratitude, where different groups from around the city would come in. Each Monday, one group would come in and one of their members would speak. And because I pretty much did all my meetings down at Oak Street. And, you know, I told you I wasn't real suburban, and a lot of the suburban meetings were just kind of discussion meetings, and they get a little dry, and sometimes their speakers were not as riveting as I would like, you know. And so it was Mount Washington night, and I thought, oh great, you know. And this guy gets up to talk who I've never seen before, so how sober can he be, right? Because I know everybody in my mind, no self-centeredness here. And he just gave this great talk. I mean, great talk. And I told him, you know, I tell everybody, I listened to him talk, and I looked at him and I said, you know, I want what he has, and I am willing to go to any lengths to get it. And that's his favorite part of my story. But we didn't start dating for another year, but we started crossing paths a little, and the next year, about when he was 2 and I was 2 and a half, we started to date, and we courted. You know, we made a decision to date with our clothes on, because neither of us really had ever done that, you know? I mean, my sponsor had to tell me that dating and sex weren't the same thing. Who knew that? And his sponsor is telling him things like, okay, Chuck, ask her out ahead of time, go to the door, you know, walk her to the car, open the car door, be sure she's in the car before you close the car door. I mean, we were clueless. And we did AA dating. You know, we did what we do. We went to coffee before the meeting or coffee after the meeting. And when you get home at night, you're never really sure if you should kiss goodnight or say the Lord's Prayer. And, but we fell in like and we fell in love, and we were married a year and a half later, and in July we'll be married 18 years, you know, and we are just having a blast. And we caught up to the kids. We actually bought a house in the neighborhood next to them, you know, because they were in a pricey neighborhood. But we got a two-family, and so we got bicycles for them 1 year for Christmas. And we thought, well, we'll get bikes too because they're still pretty little. And the first warm day, you know, we all go for a bike ride. Now we're in the suburbs, and we go for a bike ride, and it's, you know, March. And this guy's out mowing his grass because they do that there. They mow their grass a lot. We'd been down where it was concrete and, you know, our cat, when we first moved out there, our cat was freaking out because the crickets and the, you know, I mean, he was used to like ambulances and glass breaking, but the crickets were just too much for him. And the quiet, you know. So we get out on our bicycles and we're riding through, and, you know, this guy waves to us while he's mowing his grass because they wave out there too. And, you know, and I mean, where we'd been, if hands were up, there was a gun somewhere. And so, but he waves, so I wave. And about the time I wave, I look around and I realize, you know, here we are, dad, mom, big brother, little sister. We're riding through the suburbs and on our bicycles. And that old Zoom camera in my head came back for just a minute, and I kind of looked where I was, and I just thought, oh, my God. I used to own my own Harley Davidson, and I'm riding through the suburbs on a lavender Huffy. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you had said to me, Beth, guess where you're going to be when you're 4 years sober, I don't think that's what I would have guessed, you know? But the most amazing thing about that moment is right there, right then, there's nowhere I wanted to be but on that bike with those kids. And that is light years away from not even knowing if I'd know how to love them, you know? Because that's what happens here. God changes hearts here. You know, we take the action. God changes our hearts. And I learned to find that relationship with him here. You know, the big book says that a spiritual experience, it's really just an awareness of the presence of God. And so step 12 just tells me I've become aware of the presence of God as the result of these steps. I didn't find God in step 3. I didn't turn anything over to God in step 3. If I'd have known how to do it, I wouldn't have needed the other 9 steps. You know, the steps are the path I took to form a relationship with God, which has grown and deepened over the years, as any relationship will. And what a miracle that is. You know, we have a friend who says he thinks God gave us AA to just keep us busy and out of his way so that he could run our lives. And, you know, so it's like I joke sometimes AA is my shiny thing. You know, I'll be starting to think about my life and think about what I should do about my life. And the phones rings and it's a new girl. And it's like God going, woohoo, shiny thing, Beth, look at the keys, you know. Oh, okay. And I've gotten a life beyond my wildest dreams here, you know. I came in, when they tell you when you're new, if you put a list down of everything you want when you get here, you'll sell yourself short. And like so many cliches, it's true. You know, all I wanted when I got here was my driver's license back, maybe not to get arrested anymore, and maybe to marry again someday, preferably to a guy with a job, you know. And I've gotten so much more here. We did get custody of the children. The kids started, we found a house in their neighborhood. The kids started 5th and 7th grade walking out their front door, their mom and dad's house, like everybody else. And we went to our home group and handed out candy. It's a boy, it's a girl. And we'd only been married a year, so people thought maybe we were having, you know, a baby or something. They're like, oh, are you having kids? And we said, yeah, they're 9-11. Isn't it awesome? Where else can you do that but here? You know, the book says great events will come to pass. And that was a great event. And, you know, we got the kids, and then they turned into teenagers, and then we wondered why we got the kids. And we had some rough years with our son. We didn't really know if we'd ever all sit in the same room again. And, you know, 10 years later, he just bought a house 3 miles from ours in North Carolina. On purpose. And and you know, our daughter, so those little kids who were 4 and 6 when I got sober are 26 and 28 now, and they're fine adults, you know. And my son served in the Army, And my daughter's still in the Army. She just actually got back from Iraq last week. She was there for a year. And, you know, we're just blessed beyond our wildest dreams. I still like my husband. You know, we do AA together. We have a blast. Well, you know how it is. There are a lot of people in love. They don't like each other much, but they're in love. And we like each other. We like to hang out together. We like, you know, we're both active in AA. We're both sponsored. We don't sponsor each other. You know, we sponsor other people. We have a Thanksgiving breakfast at our house every year for everybody we sponsor and their families. And we have 45 people there this year, you know. And it's like the big book says, I used to wonder if I'd get my kids back. And my sponsor would say, oh, it's in the book. And they always say that, you know. And I'm pretty literal. So I'm looking for, like, if you're a single mother and your mother has your kids and you don't. One day along the line, I just saw this one little line that said, families will be reunited. And I thought, well, I'll be darned, it is in the book. And we don't always get our family back. And sometimes we shouldn't. But, you know, I always wanted to be the best or the worst. You know, just God, don't let me be average. And what I have found here is that my strength comes from being one of many. And my place in the world comes from being one of many. And that the whole time I was out there trying to be Beth the cheerleader and Beth the night auditor and Beth Jim and Sally's daughter, what I was really looking for was just Beth, child of God, you know, and learning how to play nice with all the other children of God. And we get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that families will be reunited, you know. I mean, it's like, here we are. What is this except a big family reunion of the children of God? You know, if you're new, welcome home.